So, Monica, you're just back from wandering the world. What's your favorite street food?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm just back, but
kind of. Mentally.
I had some really amazing street food in China. But while I was in Hangzhou, outside of Shanghai, it's a famous garden city, I had some pretty darn good stinky tofu. Tasted really good going down, but I didn't feel so great afterwards.
You think that had to do with the food itself? Like, because I've had stinky tofu and that's been fine.
Maybe it was just sort of the memories of pig farms I've been to as I was burping it back up on the train.
Oh, boy.
From juicy Chicago, Illinois, this is Chewing.
I'm Louisa Chu, Chicago Tribune food and dining reporter and trained chef.
And I'm Monica Eng, WBEZ food and health reporter, home cook, and food writer.
This week on Chewing, we talk global street food and Monica's surprise Shanghai dumpling.
I take you to a tiny dumpling stall in Shanghai for what I think are the world's best dumplings.
And then we hear from Chicago food historians Bruce Craig and Colleen Sen on their new book, Street Food.
Then Louisa brings in an all-American treat. But will we eat it?
All that and more on this global street food and surprise dumpling episode of Chewing.
So, Louisa, you have some family ancestry in Shanghai, is that right?
Yes, I do. My father's side of the family is all from around the Shanghai and the Nanjing area. And I had a chance to meet them for the first time just a few years ago when I was back in, well, it was my first time in Shanghai, when I guess I was back, my genes were back there for the first time visiting family.
I went there for the first time in April, and it was fascinating. What an enormous place. We were staying in a hotel that was basically like apartments, and so I would go down and check out the breakfast offerings every morning.
Oh, I love Asian hotel breakfast. Can I tell you?
No.
That's like my favorite thing.
Yeah, that's what we had in Xi'an. It was like this enormous feast of breakfast from England, America, Japan, Latin America, China. I was so done with that. I was so ready to just go and get my 35-cent pancake with egg and chives in it down by the street seller that everybody was getting on their way to work.
That too. Saved room.
But as I was eating all these different Shanghai treats, a friend's son called and said, but has she tried this certain Shenzhen Bao place on Penglai Road? All I needed to hear. And I said, tell me how to get there. My Mandarin is like five words. I don't care. I will find a way to get there because our dear friend Wen and friend of the Chewing podcast, he's like, I'm not going to get up that early. You can get up that early. I'm like, but how will I find my way? He said, you'll find your way. Just, you know, like put breadcrumbs out and you'll find your way back.
Dumpling crumbs.
And I was willing to do that. I was willing to go out into a strange city where I didn't speak the language to get these dumplings. And here's how it went. How do I say, can I have two of these?
两个.
两个.
Uh-huh.
Three of these?
三个.
三个. How do I say, how much does this cost?
多少钱.
多少钱.
Yes. And then you say, 太贵了, too expensive.
How about too cheap?
No, we don't say that.
Okay, with that language lesson in hand, I set my alarm to wake up at 5 a.m. and venture into this city of 25 million people because I just had to find this baozi.
I can't understand how I'm gonna stray. Should be sailing away.
Okay, it's about 5:40 in the morning in Shanghai, and I'm just leaving my hotel because I've heard there are these amazing dumplings in this one area of town. And armed with a little map and a few words of Mandarin, I'm gonna go find them. I'm taking a street called Jingling. And if it sounds musical to you, it is. It's a street where everybody comes to buy their instruments. Wow, there's a dog in front of me with diarrhea, gross. Ahead of me, there's a piano store, now a cello store, and you can buy a ton of ukuleles up here. here's a saxophone shop.
Why did I tell you I was going to Shanghai? I want to be with you tonight. Why did I holler I was going to Shanghai? I want to be with you tonight.
Okay, well, that's some of the ambi you get in China. I've just gotten to Penglai Road, and I've turned off Henan, and I'm looking for this stand. It's a lot busier. It's obviously a commercial road. I thought it would be sort of residential. All right, so I think I might have found the place. There's a guy outside brushing his teeth, and oh, I think I see the line. It's coming up.
Why did I tell you it was bye-bye for Shanghai? I'm even allergic to rice.
Here's where I took a bunch of video, but no audio. So let me paint you a picture. There were three ladies dressed in white coats and pink aprons. They were doing what I saw so many people doing in China on early mornings. They were stuffing hundreds of dumpling skins with delicious fillings and folding them into perfect little nubbins of delish. When they filled a whole tray, they handed them to this strong, handsome dude in a chef coat. He placed them in a giant hot iron skillet, holding about a half centimeter of oil. When the pan was full, he covered it with this enormous wooden cover and slid it over this big hot burner. The dumplings sizzled and fried until their bottoms took on this amazing golden crust. I sat there staring and filming with my phone until it was my turn in line, and the handsome guy said something like, "What, are you going to just sit there filming me, or are you going to order something?" I had no idea what he was saying, but I held up five fingers. I couldn't remember how to say three, and I didn't want three anyway. I wanted like 10, but all I could do was hold up five fingers and then ask him how much it costs. It costs the equivalent of a dollar.
Why did I tell you I was going to Shanghai? I want to be with you tonight.
Okay, so I just successfully bought five freshly fried and baked baozi. I guess they're more the size of golf balls. And they're so hot, I don't know if I'll be able to eat them on the road. So I'm going to try to run back to the house as fast as possible.
Why did I tell you I was going to Shanghai?
Then I sat down at our 17-story window overlooking Shanghai, and I made a little video of me trying this first one from the special stall. If I can find it, I'll post it on our chewing.xyz site. But here's what happened. I bit into it. It squirted all over my arm and even onto the window, and I tasted the most wonderful pork and juice and broth filling I'd ever had in my life, along with a crunch and a chew of the dough. And these days, all I want to do is go back to Shanghai and get the Shenzhen baozi again.
Oh, why did I tell you it was bye-bye for Shanghai? I'm even allergic to rice. Why don't you stop me when I talk about Shanghai?
So that was my little adventure trying these incredible, juicy, brothy handheld dumplings for the very first time. But Louisa, you think that they've got some in Chicago, right?
I know for sure. And regular listeners of Chewing will remember that I mentioned in, was it our last episode or the episode before, that they're actually in Chicago. We can find them across the street from Tribune Tower at the Lao Se Xuan restaurant on Michigan Avenue. You can find them in a lot of the, actually, it's funny, the Sichuan-style restaurants in the Chicago area. I think they think that they're sort of similar enough to making them to the Shanghai-style dumplings, you know, that they can just sort of like have the, again, sort of cross between the bao and the soup dumpling kind of experience.
So maybe you take like a soup dumpling and instead you kind of fry it on the bottom. And but the dough seems like it has to be a little sturdier.
Oh, yeah. It's
I guess
a different
we'll
dough.
Yeah, we should, we'll do a little chewing outing to check them out and see if they're any good.
A chowting.
I think you just made up a new word.
I'm back in baby's arms. How I miss those loving arms. I'm back where I belong. Back in baby's arms.
Louisa, Lisa, you have known the nerdy foodie crowd in Chicago for a long time now. Those who are food historians.
What do you mean? We are the nerdy foodie crowd.
That's true.
Actually, no. We're so nerdy that we're outside of the nerdy foodie crowd.
They're like folks who are in LTH. You were one of the big LTH folks early back in the day in the 90s.
Right. So, well, for people who may not know, LTH Forum is the Chicago-based food forum that talks about not only food in Chicago and beyond, and includes a lot of food professional amateurs, I should say. They eat a lot more actually around than I sometimes feel like I do.
And people who do food sleuthing, that's just so amazing to me. I mean, Renee G / Peter Engler.
Peter Engler, our dear friend, who is a Southside culinary expert.
Well, I was just always so amazed at what these guys know. And some of them get together and have meals. And through that, I met Colleen Sen, who is a South Asian food expert. And I've known Bruce Craig, who is a food historian, for many years. And they got together a few years ago and decided that they wanted to put together a global encyclopedia of street food. And full disclosure, I contributed the Uzbek and Central Asian segment or chapter of that.
Because why? For people who may not know our deep archives of chewing history
here. This is a deep cut. Monica lived in Central Asia for a year and a half doing some work for the UN and for other one world agencies. No. Basically, I was there with my ex-husband, who's an anthropologist. We were doing his field work. And I just wanted to do some stuff while I was out there. And I ate a lot. And so I wrote about the street food in Central Asia. It's a fascinating chapter. You should check it out. But it was in a hardcover, and it was very expensive, and it was being bought by libraries only. But recently, Agate Publishing put out this really nice paperback version that's much more accessible financially to people. And so we recently saw them at LitFest, and I sat down to talk to them about their favorite street food, why Rahm Emanuel should not outlaw our eloteros and folks who sell street food in Chicago, and a whole lot more. And so here's how that interview went. I love street food. I think we all love street food. What is it about street food that made you guys decide we need to have a global compendium?
Bruce was asked to write this book. It was originally published by another publisher as kind of an academic text. And then we decided it would be a great idea to have it, you know, in a more attractive and affordable form. So we approached Agate Publisher in Evanston, and they put this lovely volume out that you see.
When they asked me to do it, I realized I only knew some parts of the world, but I knew somebody who knew a lot about South Asia, the expert on Indian food, Colleen. And she'd been all over the world because of a job she once had. And of course, she's a foodie. So we worked together really well.
And then, of course, we also invited people in areas we didn't know from the Oxford Food Symposium, and you yourself were one of the contributors.
I can't believe I forgot that. Yes, disclosure. I contributed stuff about Uzbek street food for this. Boy, that was so long ago. But it's out, and it's fantastic. So what did you learn about street food, its commonalities and its uniqueness as you put this together, wrote it, edited it, compiled it?
Well, there are many commonalities, and the introduction covers that. And these range from economics, the economics of street food, which is it's a way for poor people, low-income people, to get into the greater market. And this is especially the case in first-world countries. But in countries, lesser developed countries, it is a way for families to make an actual living. And this may be their level, middle range level in those countries. And there are many others ranging from methods of preparation to ingredients to concerns about health and other matters. But I think what interests us is the quality of the food and the people.
Well, one thing that we found is what an important role street food plays in the meals and the diet of most of the world. I mean, not so much, of course, in North America, but in South Asia, in Africa, in Southeast Asia, people eat 40 to 50% of all their diet comes from street food, often because they don't have big kitchens. you know, even in ancient Rome, I saw this thing on TV that people lived in these tiny little apartments, so they ate street food. So street food has been there from time immemorial, and for many people in the world, it's a major source of nutrition. It's not just for fun like it is for us.
You know, I think a lot of people say, oh, if you're eating outside the home, it must be because you're rich. But for a lot of the people for whom it's a large part of their diet, it's not because they're rich. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. But cooking at home is fairly recent. I mean, there's a joke that a colleague of mine says, a historian said, what did a 17th century upper middle class bourgeois Parisian order for dinner? They ordered out. Because they didn't have kitchens, they couldn't bake. So all their meats were roasted in the bake shop. All their breads were made from the bake shop. And a lot of stuff was made by specialists in essentially street food that were brought in the house. It's only recent that we've had kitchens that where people are cooking. So home cooking is a really interesting, fairly modern phenomenon.
Some of the opposition to street food in cities like Chicago is that it takes away from the restaurant industry. But in fact, there's been a couple of studies done, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, that shows that when street food availability increases, so does restaurant going. It really had a very positive effect on restaurant participation. So once people start eating out, they want to eat out more.
What are your rules of thumb for finding both delicious and safe street food?
Yeah, we get into this in the book because we have the World Health Organization's 5 rules to street food. The number one thing is the food should be hot and you should see it made in front of you. Somebody cooks it, they hand it to you, you're okay. If it sits there, you're in trouble. What do you think?
Right, and you don't know what people are doing in restaurants. But here, it is foods taken straight from the market, brought by the vendor to the site, peeled. Because actually, most world street food is not meat; it's mostly vegetables.
Yes, it is.
And
yes.
Or fruits, they're cut right on the spot, so you know that they're okay.
In Chicago, I've been fighting this fight for a long time, just as an eater and a journalist, trying to get the Chicago Department of Health to find some way to certify the folks who peel the mangoes, cut the pineapple, make the corn right in front of you. You being world street food experts, why should Rahm and the Commissioner of Public Health in Chicago, why should they consider letting this city be a street food city too?
I'm with you completely. I am for street food from the vendor's point of view because I think it's a way for people to make a living, and especially immigrants, which is the historic pattern. But I think that street food is healthier. I'll tell you, there was a study done in 1909 in New York to look at street food. Now, imagine what it was like in New York in 1909, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they were filthy. The cities were filthy. Yeah. To decide whether the restaurants, who complained mightily about the street food vendors who had their push carts with kerosene lamps, whether they're healthier. Well, they did an intensive study, and guess what? They decided that the street food vendors were healthier food than the restaurants for the reasons I mentioned before, because they went to the market, they got it fresh, and they couldn't keep it. They didn't have refrigeration. So whatever they didn't have, they discarded that day. You're getting fresh food every single day.
What I asked the city as they were pushing against what are called eloteros sometimes, the guys who make the fruit cups, I said, how many times have you had someone report to the health department that they got sick on one of these? Nobody. Nobody in the health department can find a single instance. And yet they're constantly saying, oh, sorry, they're just too dangerous. We couldn't possibly legalize them and regulate them.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's irrational. You know, a lot of the eloteros or the paleteros, they come from Mexico, where it's eaten on the street and nobody gets sick. Mm-hmm. I've eaten more paletas in Mexico because it's hot. You know, like in hot Merida, for example, where you're sweating and dying. I lived on paletas. I never got sick.
Yeah.
So.
And if we're talking about public health, the idea that you would produce this very attractive fresh fruit cup to children rather than Flamin' Hot Cheetos, maybe it's even worth a health risk, which there's been no proof that there is.
Well, you know, I've been to India about 20 times and absolutely never get sick because I follow the guideline I said. Now, what's interesting, in countries like, as you know, Thailand and Singapore and Malaysia, there's been a trend to take the street food vendors and put them into courts. Again, the ostensible reason is sanitation and health. I think one of the main reasons is real estate. They're taking very valuable property. They don't want them clogging the streets. You have these high-rises going up. So I think that there's, especially in Hong Kong as well, there's certainly these considerations that come into it. I don't know if that's so true in North America, but certainly in Asia, where there's been an attempt to, I think, sanitize and corral street food vendors, this has been a consideration.
Okay, let's get down and dirty. Let's talk about food. I want you guys to think about the most delicious street foods all over the world. Get a mental top five list, because I'm going to put you on the spot. I can start with mine if you need a little more time.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I really love a good greasy bowl of plov in Tashkent.
Yeah.
There are these guys with these giant cauldrons of this orange rice. And you bring your own ceramic bowl. I would imagine at this point maybe they have plastic bowls. But at that time when I was living there, and they just scoop this wonderful carrot-laden, greasy rice with big chunks of lamb on top. And boy, is that one of the most satisfying things I've ever had. And if you can get some fresh bread there and maybe some Korean carrot salad, boy, you're set for a long time.
That sounds great. Well, I was just talking to a Mongolian person. Mm-hmm. And this is a dish I have not had. I've eaten Mongolian momos, and I think Colleen has. But she was telling me that the best momos are made with horse meat. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there's nothing but horses in. And she said, in the wintertime, we eat horses. I said, well, Americans don't, because she said, what? That's ridiculous. Why can't you eat horses? And she said, she went on about healthy food. So that's aspirational.
Yeah.
I mean, I like horses, but still.
Well, horse meat tends to not have great intramuscular fat. It's either lean or fat, and I found that to be an issue when I was in Central Asia.
Well, it's the same with bison. Anyway, my favorite would be a kind of a taco, which is made in Puebla or Cholula, even better. And we look at markets as also street food, because the fondas are a form of street food. Mm-hmm. And there's one there that makes a blue corn tortilla loaded with Oaxacan cheese, with corn fungus,
huitlacoche,
and a sauce. And they fold it up and they just put it on the griddle till it melts. It is one of the best things I have ever eaten, ever, anywhere. I yearn to go to Cholula to eat this. That's my top one.
So it sounds like a huitlacoche quesadilla in a blue corn tortilla.
Yeah, that's what it is. But it's just, but you know, it's the atmosphere also. That not just the ambiance, but the smell, and which adds to the flavor of the thing.
Well, you know, I go to India all the time, so that's the street food I know the best. Last time I was there, I went to Mumbai for the first time, and the most emblematic Bombay street food is called vada pav. And what it is, it's kind of mashed vegetables on a griddle, and it's served with a roll, a Western-style roll. It's pav or pav, which is from the Portuguese. And so I went with one of the local newspapers. I'd never had it, so they took me around to all these different places. They said, we want your judgment. You know nothing about it. So we went to five places. The interesting thing was the very best, which was so full of flavor, I mean, was in a very hole in the wall. It's a Jain place, so they didn't use any onions or garlic. Very cheap, maybe 25 cents. And then there was another place that was all, you know, glass, and they had hairnets on, and it was the most tasteless thing that you had. I mean, it had no soul, no life. So that was my first experience, and I really, really enjoyed it. I mean, and apparently, if I can just say this, it arose during the American Civil War, because there was a blockade of cotton. So the British turned to the mills in Bombay, and they were working 24 hours to spin, you know, textiles. So this was just a way of using leftover vegetables to feed the textile workers. That's one theory of it, too. So this owes its roots to America.
Oh, that's something to add to our Civil War stories. Yeah.
So it's like a veggie burger on the go for people who need to make cotton.
Yeah.
I have to say that I love Mexico City, and I love going to eat there all the time. And friends always want to go to fancy places and sit down places. But whenever I see anybody with a basket, called a canasta in Spanish, I always get every tacos de canasta I see. It's just people who have piled up tacos inside this basket that's lined with fabric. And they're usually like dipped in some sort of sauce so that they stay warm. And I have never gone wrong with one of those. Well, okay, maybe one or two. But and they cost like 10 cents each.
Right. No, I completely agree with you. Not just Mexico City, any city in Mexico. And it's so regional that you're going to get different things in different. So Oaxaca is going to be different from others. But you can't go wrong with any street food there. It's always really great. Now, having said that, since we're in Chicago, go to the Maxwell Street Market.
Exactly.
That is almost as good as you can get in Mexico. And they come from different regions. And that place that does Oaxacan tamales,
yeah,
those are absolutely great. It's the first place I head for.
Yeah, and that same place that does Oaxacan tamales, when they have pozole, especially on a cold winter morning or fall morning, yeah, their pozole is fantastic too. Well, everybody goes to Ruby's, yeah, but the lines are so long. Yeah. We go to the place right next to Ruby's, and I can't remember the name, but their mole quesadilla on freshly made tortillas that they just make right there,
yeah,
unbelievable.
I know the place. And you can also get pupusas there now.
Oh, they've got Salvadorans there.
They do, yeah. One place at least.
In the subcontinent, there's certain dishes that they serve in the Muslim quarters of the major cities, like or in Hyderabad. And one of them is nihari, which is this wonderful, it's usually beef dish, and it's stewed overnight, usually on hot coals, and it's very dark, spicy gravy. So people would, you know, when they break their fast, they would go and have this, or they'd have it first thing in the morning before they start their fast. And there's other dishes too. And now, it's so funny, because India's getting so, I don't know what the word is, there's a whole foodie contingent there. So now they're having street walks like they do here. Okay. So in Hyderabad, they said, well, we're having halim. Halim is this multi-grain dish. So we're having a halim walk, you know, so sign up for this. And I mean, it's just amazing how people are discovering these food, because one thing about street food, and this is true everywhere, it wasn't something middle-class people ate. It had certain suspicion about it, like it was considered dirty and kind of naughty, and, you know, it wasn't the right thing to eat. You know, and middle-class parents wouldn't let their children eat it. They would eat it sneakily because it was forbidden. So the fact that now this is kind of entering more into the mainstream is interesting. And maybe part of it is people coming back from, you know, U.S. cities and kind of doing this sort of thing.
Yeah.
There's this pancake that you can get in most parts of northern China,
yeah,
that's kind of like a dough cake that they'll spread on the griddle, and then they'll whip up some scrambled eggs, and then they'll put that layer on there, and then chives, scallions, maybe some fermented bean sauce. And I can't find it anywhere in Chicago, so I've started to make it. It's called Jianbing. And there's so many street foods that we still need to have in Chicago.
I know.
There's an Indian dish like that. It's called Mughlai Paratha. And that basically, it's a paratha with kind of egg with onions and chilies and things like that. And when you see them, if you go to a fair, the guys will throw it up like a pizza, and it'll be this huge thing. And I've tried to make it at home, too. And it's kind of an approximation.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the combination of bread and eggs and spices is so,
yeah,
so perfect.
Mm.
It's like the early McMuffin. You can sort of hold it in your hand and go to work.
Well, a lot of the bings in North China are completely tasteless. They're just these,
right,
little cakes.
Right.
But that one sounds really good. So here's a variation. Somebody told me in Israel. I've been in Israel, but I never saw it there. It's a pancake with hard-boiled eggs on it, a kind of a pizza with hard-boiled eggs on it, which sounds like a terrible variation of what you two were just talked about.
Yeah, you know, you get your egg. So I would say in the former Yugoslavia, my favorite was I ate burek all,
yeah,
day long, cheese and meat. They were 50 cents. And then sladoled, which is their gelato. And so I walked around and got, I think I gained 20 pounds,
right,
in pre-war Yugoslavia.
Yeah, me too. I was there also in Tito's time. And the slastichana was
oh, yeah,
really great. But on the coast, the seafood was about the best I've ever eaten. They just charcoal grilled it,
oh, yeah,
right there. I can still taste the pulpo and the squid.
It's, yeah, interesting. Some countries really don't have much street food, though. Like when we were doing the book, we found that. Like, you know, France, for example, there isn't really a great thriving street food culture in France. It's considered kind of bad form to eat in the street. Ethiopia, too, it's considered really bad manners to eat on the street. And I think there's certain, you know, now I guess in Paris, because of the, you know, the people from North Africa, there's more vendors that are open up, and there's even, yeah, a couple of American style street foods, because saying something is Brooklyn is, you know, considered
yeah,
fast. But some countries aren't Northern Europe either. We didn't find much there.
Yeah, there is street food, but it's not as prevalent as,
yeah,
and they serve things like, I mean, in Denmark, for example, pulser,
which is
hot dogs.
Right, so you get your wieners, you get your pretzels, and you get some crepe stands in France,
yeah,
but that's about it.
And of course, frites.
Frites.
I mean,
Belgian
frites. Fab.
Bruce and Colleen, you also have another fantastic book coming out, dear to my heart, not just because I contributed some items for it, but it's the Encyclopedia of Chicago Food. I know you're not supposed to talk a lot about it, but can you tell me a little bit? Can you give us just a little amuse-bouche about it?
Yeah, it's called the Chicago Food Encyclopedia. University of Illinois Press, it'll be out September 1st. It is a compendium of food in Chicago from the day Chicago was founded and before to the present day. And we have an overview of the whole food history of Chicago and many contributors, 70, including yourself, and many others who everybody will know when they see their names. These are people who really know Chicago. And it has in it things that no other encyclopedia of food have. For example, we have an entry on literature, food and literature, mm-hmm. in Chicago literature. So if you read James T. Farrell, my favorite Chicago novelist, you'll see, you know, on the Washington Park Irish and Sister Carrie and, you know, Edna Ferber's in there.
Yes.
And then we have manufacturing, equipment, and the companies that make Chicago's a major center for food equipment, food technology. Chicago is the center for food technology, one of the centers. These things that people don't know that make up the whole food scene and make Chicago the center of American food.
Mayor Emanuel wrote a little endorsement for us, and he said it's the greatest food city and the greatest city in America, with which we wholeheartedly agree.
Well, I look forward to it, and I look forward to reading more about street food. And if anybody's looking for the street food, you don't even have to remember the complicated name. You can simply go onto Amazon, look for Sen, S-E-N, or Craig, K-R-A-I-G, and street food, and you'll find their wonderful compendium of global street food. Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much, Monica.
Thanks. Bye.
So, Monica, with all of that lovely, delicious global food, we actually had a rare treat pop up here in Chicago, thanks to the internet, which is kind of its own, like, mean streets of its own sometimes. There was a lemon cake that was brought back at Portillo's, the Chicago area based hot dog and Italian beef, another like hot dog type food chain. Are you familiar with this whole lemon cake saga?
I know nothing about the
really?
Lemon cake.
What? No way.
I try to stay away from simple carbohydrates and simple sugars.
Oh, please. There's nothing simple about this, actually. It's made from all sorts of chemicals in a mix, I'm sure. Actually, I don't know that for sure. So Portillo's, don't sue us because we have no money anyway. But
That's right. For the podcast, it'll never have an ad. Ever.
That's right.
Ever.
So the story behind this lemon cake from Portillo's is that a Reddit user, are you familiar with Reddit?
I've heard it. And I'm not even joking here. I still don't understand what that kid is.
Okay.
But see, I let you be the lemon cake right. and Reddit expert, so I don't
there
have to.
There you go. So Reddit is a website. It's on the internet. You log
website.
In. Exactly. And so there's lots of stuff that's posted on there. So a user on Reddit posted basically a bounty saying that he remembered this lemon cake from Portillo's, but they discontinued it. He offered $300 to anyone who could help him get the recipe so that he could finally make it for himself. And so a very savvy Portillo's marketing person then thought, hey, we can get you that lemon cake. So they're famous in the Chicago area also for their chocolate cake, which I actually...
And they're hot dogs, right?
Yeah.
But I don't
right.
understand why someone in Chicago goes to Portillo's for hot dogs. I don't. But
actually,
maybe they're good. Who
yeah.
knows?
Well, we'd be discussing this, I think, probably in a food month coming up at the Tribune. But hot dogs at Portillo's, it's basically they make a standard... correct Vienna-style, Chicago-style hot dog, you know, with, like, all the different, like, neon green topping,
yeah,
relish
yeah,
and all that.
I've done stories about that, actually, with Bruce
I know
Craig.
You have, yeah. but for people who may not be familiar
right.
with Portillo's and the Chicago-style, right.
Seven
staple toppings.
But it's called, like, the Super 7 or something. I can't remember.
Right. In
Those
any
stories
case.
Just go right out of my brain after I'm done with them.
That's good to know. In any case, so they brought back this
Chicago
lemon cake.
Chicago 7, that's what they call
right.
it.
There we go. Okay. So they brought back this lemon cake for a limited time while supplies last only. So I went out and got a whole lemon cake.
Of course you did.
Of course, exactly, because it's more economical. 10 servings for like $19.99 or like per slice, like $5. Hello.
That'll keep in your purse for a while.
It's actually been in the Tribune fridge for like about a week and a half now. But
fridges tend to dry out bread products. Just want to say.
Tend to. Well, but these are covered and it's been in the fridge and I'm not sure. But in any case, the other little known product that came back in addition to this lemon cake, which didn't come back right away, was also a lemon cake shake. I wasn't so excited about the lemon cake because I read that it was like yellow cake with lemon frosting. Okay.
Yeah.
Lemon cake shake, though.
Lemon cake.
Right. A milkshake blended with actual lemon cake, which apparently this Reddit user who brought it back, who sort of instigated the whole thing, discovered they did not offer right away. Again, savvy Portillo's people, and we are, trust me, we're not being paid by Portillo's. I
mean, we're trying to be paid anybody. By Aldi, but they're just not.
No, we're not.
The hint.
We're not trying. But
we try at nothing.
So they started making this lemon cake shake, apparently, after people started asking, because their chocolate cake shake is a thing as well. So I got the lemon cake.
I love how you say it's a thing.
Yeah,
oh,
right.
You and all the kids with
what?
That thing.
No, I don't know that. Okay, I'm far from being
it's
a kid.
One of my pet peeves.
Oh.
You know, the English language is going down the tubes.
Oh, boy. Oh,
everybody's
boy.
Saying, oh, is that a thing?
That's right.
Yeah, that's a
yeah.
thing.
Okay,
oh,
all right.
What thing?
Apparently, Monica's had too many interactions with her dear teenage daughter, Miranda, lately, who was not using a computer all night, okay? But
right.
Anyway, so
I found it on in your bed.
So I got not only a whole lemon cake, but a lemon cake shake. So I tasted it. So spoiler alert, I wasn't so excited about the cake.
So it's like a vanilla shake and you stick some lemon cake in it?
Right. Actually, it's a vanilla shake. Yeah. With yellow cake with some lemon frosting. But what I did, though, was I stuck an extra slice of lemon cake in there.
Oh, even more lemon cakey.
But I was just on Worldview with her dear friend, Tony Sarabia.
Who's filling in for Jerome McDonald
yes,
this week.
Who is on vacation, who deserves it. And I thought, you know, I know Monica's not going to really care about the lemon cake, nor the lemon cake shake.
But there was that dude from Molly who talked about spicy smoothies.
And I actually brought in some spice. And I was thinking, and you gave me, Monica, from the WBEZ, your WBEZ rooftop garden, a Hungarian wax pepper that your dear...
Which is hot as the Dickens.
Well, actually, not necessarily. On the scale...
How do you know hot a Dickens is?
Right, well...
Depends on the Dickens you're talking about.
Okay, this is still a family show. Actually, it's not really. But in any case, there was on this Worldview segment earlier, a guy called in from Molly and said that his dad loved to blend habanero peppers in his breakfast smoothie. And so I actually had brought in some black pepper to grind in there, plus some of the spice packet from my spicy Korean noodles. But when you gave me the pepper, I thought, I'm going to slice up some pepper. Maybe that might be some good to add some flavor to it.
I think I'm just going to take a bite of the pepper. Then I'm going to have some of the lemon shake. Because the other thing you learned on that segment was that water is no good in terms of wiping away the heat because it's fat soluble. You're going to need something with fat. So lassi or milk or something else fatty.
Right. But I was going to say, though, is that if in an emergency, like I mentioned with Tony earlier, is that a lot of water will flush it out. So think of those like washing stations. If you have way too much hot pepper, if you drink a lot of water, it'll wash some of it away. So,
or just go to an eye washing station and stick your mouth on it.
No, don't do that. Please, nobody, please.
All right. So you've brought me the lemon cake shake with a piece of lemon cake and the Hungarian pepper.
Right.
And
no straw, because we are trying to reduce our usage of straws now.
Right.
And
who decided that they're not going to have straws? DMK.
Mm-hmm.
So a restaurant group in Chicago has decided no more plastic straws.
Right. And our dear friend Phil Battelle wrote about that in the Tribune. And I learned that Miami Beach actually banned them 5 years ago from Phil's story.
Whoa. That,
yeah, because they are a huge environmental, another huge environmental hazard. Yeah. Go figure that a whole bunch of plastic used one time is going to be a bad thing. So, unfortunately, I do have the only cup that they would serve it in, which is one of these foam cups, but one of our little bamboo straws. So I'm going to offer you, Monica, the lemon cake shake with Hungarian wax pepper. Will you eat/drink it?
I will. And, you know, I had some of this pepper early this morning because I made breakfast at work. And I thought, oh, I'll have this nice sweet pepper with it. And yow, 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 I got the hiccups. Do you ever get hot pepper hiccups?
No.
Yeah, when something's very hot, I get the hiccups. Mm. When it's super hot, I get nauseated. And
oh, boy.
Then, you know, sick. But when it's just the right thing, usually I'll get just a little hiccupy. Do you remember the guy from Molly? He was saying that eating hot food means he'll never get constipated.
Right.
And then I thought he followed up by saying, meaning that my nose is always clear.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's what constipated means.
No. No, I think he meant actually constipated by eating spicy foods that he would never get constipated or congested, actually, which I thought that our dear friend Tony Sarabia caught very well, that hot peppers are also known for their medicinal purposes, too.
Like as laxatives?
It can be.
Yeah. Okay, so here I am. I'm going to bite into this super hot pepper.
You took a giant, oh boy, Monica's taking a big, like inch-long yeah. bite of a yeah. really, boy, you didn't have to take you didn't have to take such a giant bite.
Oh man, I got
bite.
It on my lips.
Oh man, we should totally be taking like total kid video in this.
Oh, give me a gallon of milk.
Oh my gosh. Okay, well, you do have a giant lemon cake shake in front of you.
Way too sweet.
So, okay.
I can't believe I'm eating the sweetness.
I know. So Monica's like digging into the shake, and you're probably going to get brain freeze. So your mouth is burning, your brain is freezing.
Okay, Louisa, now you got to do it.
Okay, hold on. I got to take my teeth out. Hold on. So
recently got dentures, and that's okay.
Regular listeners of Chewing might notice that I have a bit of a speech impediment right now because I actually did get those Invisalign, not dentures. But I joke about it saying that grandma's going to take her dentures out. So, boy, so you want to describe the flavor of that while I do that? Oh, boy, are you okay?
So, like, the whole back of my throat is coated in pain.
Oh, no.
But kind of a tingly, nice pain, too.
And then because Monica, the thrill seeker.
The sugar from that incredibly sweet frosting. But then the coolness from the shake was kind of nice. And now I'm scratching my leg really hard to dull the pain.
What?
In my throat. If you look at my leg, there are big white scratch marks on it.
Wait, but we're learning so many odd little, I don't know,
between your dentures and my scratching my leg off.
Why do you scratch your leg when you
to try to contain the pain?
What? No, I don't know this.
Transfer pain spots.
Uh-oh.
Okay, now the burping is happening. Wow, Louisa, it's not hot at all. I think you should take a bite. I think you should take those off on mic.
Monica, it's a medical condition. So as one ages, your teeth shift, so I learned. And so now as I discovered in chatting with my Tribune colleague and cubicle neighbor Adam Lukacs is that, he remembers this from junior high. So he as a young junior high boy and me as a lady of a certain age.
Right?
I'm not comparing notes. So me never having braces as a kid, I get to now relive the life of an adolescent boy. So I am going
I'd like to remind you, this is a health podcast. So that's why we're talking about dental
right,
issues.
Exactly. Trust me, dental care is very, very important. I know after having gotten my dad implants, teeth. So,
yeah, and Medicare right. doesn't pay for it. It's crazy.
Yep. You know. Nope. Seniors, boy, you know what I'm talking about. So I am taking a nibble. Monica, you seriously took a giant bite.
Don't
like
let
I
it
said,
get on your lips.
So this pepper is like a lovely light chartreuse green, and it's about like about an inch and a half, like in diameter. And you took like about an inch long, like bite,
yeah,
like
too much.
I'm taking just a nibble of it because I saw
you
what happened.
Get some membrane and some pepper. You got to get some membrane and seed though.
Oh right. Oh, so this is actually another point that I wanted to mention. Didn't get a chance to mention when I was talking to Tony. Is that a lot of people think that the heat is in the seeds, and other people say no, that's a lie. And actually, for most spicy peppers, it's actually in the placenta around the seeds that you'll find most of the heat. But now there is a new study that was discovered that it may be distributed differently, and some peppers might have it actually in the skin as well. And you might find it through black light.
Is the placenta the same as the membrane?
In the inside?
Yeah.
It's like the membrane. You're thinking maybe the white pith and the ribs?
Yeah.
Not only. No, it's actually like the thin membranes that's around the seeds themselves. And so effectively, it's the seeds that hold that. So I'm just going to take a nibble.
Stuff around the seeds,
I'm going to take it. Right. So I'm going to take a nibble. Okay. I took a nibble. And that, super spicy. I'm not crazy.
But you're really cooling it down with the cake and the shake.
And actually, the combo is way better.
It is kind of nice. You know, now I'm with that guy from Molly's dad. I think a spicy shake would be good.
So while I was not such a huge fan of the much touted lemon cake, which is on Jimmy Kimmel, actually, it was funny, from Portillo's, nor the lemon cake shake, adding a little bit of your WBEZ Rooftop Garden Hungarian wax pepper, Monica, will we eat it? Yes, we did. This made it much better.
I think we've got a delicious combo on our hands.
Chewing is an independent production of us, Louisa Chu and Monica Eng.
Our juicy producer is Iris Lin.
Listen to all our episodes at chewing.xyz and chicagotribune.com/chewingpodcast.
And please subscribe to our podcast for free wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us while you're there.
Plus, like us on Facebook at facebook.com/chewingpodcast.
Or follow us on Twitter at Chewing Podcast or at Louisa Chu or at Monica Eng.
Thank you for listening to Chewing. I'm Louisa Chu.
And I'm Monica Eng. And until we meet again in 2 weeks, keep it global, street foodish, and juicy.
That was kind of wandering.